Welcome to the coffee table. I'm Kathleen Gustafson. This morning, you'll hear Sound Connections, Marine Mammals, the Ocean, and Us, presented by Dr. Michael Castellini. The program was recorded on Wednesday, February 19th, at Kachemak Bay campus of Kenai Peninsula College as part of their monthly Public Square Lecture Series. In this presentation, you'll hear Dr. Castellini share his expertise on the sounds of marine mammals above and below the water, under sea ice, and on rookeries. You'll hear stories, sound recordings, and musical pieces created with marine mammal sounds. And Dr. Castellini will discuss how we hear sound and how man-made noise is increasing on and in the ocean. Now here's Kachemak Bay Campus Director Reed Brewer to introduce Dr. Michael Castellini.
So I'm honored today to introduce our next Public Square speaker, Dr. Michael Castellini, who I've known for 120 years. Mike earned his PhD from Scripps Institute of Oceanography in 1981 and was a faculty member at the University of Alaska Fairbanks for over 25 years.
So 31 now.
All right, 31. But what a lot of people don't know about him is he was the founding science director for the Alaska Sea Life Center in Seward. He was the director of the Institute of Marine Science and at UAF, the associate dean, and then the dean of the School of Fisheries, which is now called the College of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. And currently, Mike is the interim dean for the University of Alaska Fairbanks Graduate School, the research director for National Institute of Health Education Enhancement Programs at UAF. His research over the last 200 years he's been alive has focused on marine mammals and how they've adapted to life in the sea. He's participated in hundreds and thousands of public outreach programs discussing climate change, the Arctic, the Antarctic, including how those animals at locations are critically dependent on the sea ice. And I've heard second or maybe fourth hand that he spent so much time in Antarctica that they named part of an island after him, the Castellini Bluffs, which I heard are a nasty, unrelenting place. Dr. Castellini has chaired and co-chaired 16 PhD and master's students, published more than 100 scientific journals, participated in 20 scientific field expeditions on land, sea, and ice. He has been involved in a number of programs, National Science Foundation funded program called the Polar Palooza, where he worked with high school students trying to get them interested and excited about science, Arctic science, cold climate science. As well as the Center for Ocean Science Education Excellence, the COSE program, that brings scientists, public, and school children together in Alaska on the issue of climate change. I would say it's an absolute honor to have him here, Dr. Michael Castellini.
Thank you, Reed. When Reed called back in November and said he wanted to do this, I had heard talks before that were done totally just as stories, totally just with sound, and it really, really impressed me. One of the things that we did today, just for dinner, the group that was with me didn't know that I was doing an experiment at the same time, the three of us that were there. And I was listening to them talk, and I could hear what they were saying. I could hear the conversation. But, you know, there's 25 other conversations going on at the same time. How did I not listen to the other 25 conversations, but listen to the ones that were right here in front of me? So we're actually going to start this with an experiment tonight. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to have you start, and I just need you to start talking. Talk about what the weather was like the last time. I just need noise, but I want you to be saying something, not la, 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 la. All right, so I'm going to start with them. After they're doing that for 3 or 4 seconds, I'm going to go to you, and then I'm going to go to you, and then we'll do the experiment. Go ahead, start talking. Talk out loud, just talk. All right. You guys, go ahead, start talking now about something. Make it up, talk about the dessert, whatever you want to do. Okay, I need you guys to start talking now too. Okay, we're good. Thank you. Thank you. So that was a great experiment. Now we get to do the real experiment. Can any one person here tell me what somebody over there was talking about, or even better, explain to me the social culture of humans and how they talk to each other and from what you heard in that cacophony there. You can't. It's just noise, right? So imagine now you're all a whole bunch of dolphins or whales. You're all out there making noise. And I'm a scientist. I walk in here and drop a microphone into the room. And that's what I hear, except it's whale sounds. It's not talking like you hear it. And now somebody turns to me and says, can you please explain whale culture to me and whale communications, and can we talk to them? That's the issue, right? How can you take what you just heard and make it into a story of how whales work or how dolphins talk to one another? It's a complex problem, and it's not solved by just putting a microphone in the... Now, surely we're going to hear a bunch of cool things tonight. But there's an example of saying, wow, I'd love to talk to dolphins, but you're not going to do it that way, right? It's going to be a whole other story. Okay, so one thing we y'all learned in school, that, you know, 75% of the earth is ocean, right? You guys, in Fairbanks, you want to have liquid water, so it's really nice to be here where there's liquid water again. And there's 75% of the ocean, of the planet's surface is ocean. What's rarely known or very discussed, though, is that when you consider how deep the ocean is also, an average depth of 4,000 meters, 95% of the living space on this planet is in the ocean. And so if you were doing an extraterrestrial search for life, like we do on planets all over the universe right now, you want to look for water. And for oxygen and water, both is what you want to look for. Because that's probably where the life's going to be. There's a little bit of stuff on the surface scum where we all live, but most of the 95% of the life, habitable space on the planet's in the ocean. So it really is important. You guys are all totally tuned into the ocean. This would be a totally different talk if I was in Fairbanks. You guys already know the ocean very, very well. And so my job tonight is to tell you a little bit what happens when you drop that microphone. And in the ocean world, marine science world, is called a hydrophone. When you drop the hydrophone into the ocean, and you know, what do you hear? If you're lucky, you can find a particular mammal talking and hear what she is saying. And not a whole bunch of noise. Okay, so the other thing that we've done too is we've romanticized over the years marine mammals. They're up sort of on this romantic pedestal. We have whale songs and all sorts of things. We're gonna talk first of all about how we've taken some whale music and made it into music ourselves. And see, I still have to do PowerPoints, just I do it over here. See, you guys don't see it, but I have to see it. All of you old hippies and all of us are 200 years old, remember the Paul Winter consort. And they did lots and lots and lots of music with animals, wolves, and all sorts of things. And about 50 years ago were some of the very first recordings of singing whales. And they incorporated that into their concerts. And Judy Collins did also. And some music I'm going to play here for you. Let's make sure this works. Paul Winter consort here first. Whales. Remember all this from college? No! you youngins. Pretty good mimic there of a whale sound, yeah. Also, then, not long after that, was Judy Collins came in with Farewell to Tarwathi also.
Farewell to Tarwathi, adieu Mormonee,
whales in the back.
And the dear land of Crimond, I bid thee farewell. We're bound off for Greenland. ready to sail in hopes to find riches in hunting the whale.
Both of those albums took music from Roger Payne, who in 1970 put the first album out that had whale songs and whale music to it. And it just went wild. I have the album at home. It was, you know, these are these beautiful sounds. And it was the beginning of this concept of saying, wow, you know, these aren't just animals out in the ocean. There's something going on there. Now, the great irony of this is we sort of say, wow, look, in 1970, actually it started with some World War II stuff. In 1950, we found out whales made noise. I'd be willing to bet you a significant amount of money that if you ask the Inuit and the Greenlandic indigenous peoples and everybody else in the north, do whales make noise? They would have said 500 years ago, we were hearing this noise. You guys just caught up with us in 1949 when we got the first recordings. So in fact, whaling captains talk about being able to hear that through the hull of the ship. But you know for sure that the northern indigenous peoples knew about this long, long before any of us did. So that's sort of a fascinating history in and of itself, and how that goes. Okay, so now let's go to, we're gonna start off with some seals here. And tonight we're gonna tell you a bunch of stories. We're gonna talk about stories with seals and sea lions. Then we'll move into whales, and I'll talk about some of the things that humans are doing with the ocean. So this is a bearded seal. I'm gonna do some of the Arctic ones first. This is a very interesting sound. You should like this one. Really cool thing about that is when you are out on the sea ice, on the surface of the ice, you can hear that coming through the ice. It is so loud. And you are looking for the spaceship, right? I mean, it really is, you're going, there's something, aliens are landing here. This is a bizarre thing. A whole other field we could talk about is the idea of, can you actually census the number of people in this room if I had really, really good microphones in this case and could point them over here and point them over here and point them over here and then triangulate to figure out there's about 20 different voices over here and maybe 20 over here. And that's the way they do a lot now of the bowhead whale counting in the Arctic and the bearded seal counting, the whole series of hydrophones and all this really fancy, sophisticated triangulation to try to figure out where everything is. So just keep this in your mind of when you hear all these ocean noises, these are animals communicating with one another. You know, the pup's going, mom, you know, the calf's going, where are you, mom? You know, and this, all this conversation's going on. How are you? Where have you been? What are you doing? All is happening, but they can focus it. So yes, there's noise everywhere, which is what you hear when you put in the hydrophone, but of course they're communicating with one another, and all those sounds, those are male bearded seals saying, I'm cool, come here. Okay, let's do this one. This is a ribbon seal, also in the north. How similar that is. That's probably a pyramid seal on the background. These are just not things that you would think that the noises that an animal would make. Like I said, we can do this all night. So now I'm going to take you to the Antarctic near Castellini Bluff and to seals that are there called Weddell seals, which I've worked on for years and years. And you've just heard the two northern species do the trilling spaceship story, right? Sound. Let's listen to Weddell seals here. How similar that is. Isn't that amazing? I mean, these are. But I think what it is in this particular case, it's the ice. It's the fact that these animals live in heavy, heavy ice. And we know for sure that, because we've been able to hear this, that they don't echolocate like dolphins and things. But what they can do is make a noise that can bounce off either the bottom or the surface of the ice. And they can sort of place themselves because it's dark. You're down 1,000 meters. You're under 20 feet of ice and it's wintertime, there's no light. Where am I? And I think they use this, there's those particular types of sounds and the tick, 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 tick sounds to try to do an echo sound. It's not true. High frequency echo sound is the same thing that I can walk up and stand next to this pillar and I know there's something there just simply by the way my voice sounds. And so the same way blind people can obviously recognize when somebody's near them and how sound changes and everything. Your kids, you teach them how to figure out how far away the lightning storm is by going, boom, lightning, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, boom, thunder, we've got, 4,000 feet away, roughly. But here's the other trick and relevant to us here tonight. The speed of sound in air is about 1,000 feet per second. In water, which is much more dense, it's 5,000 feet per second. So the ability to transmit sound quickly is much different in water than it is in air. And the next time you go swimming in the pool here, put your head totally underwater, go to the bottom of the pool or something, and try to figure out where a sound is coming from. You can't. You are tuned to air moving your ears around, and you're no longer hearing with your ears there. You're hearing with your whole head underwater because there's no air inside your ears doing this. And sound's coming to you 5 times faster. If you can figure out where that's coming from, the Navy wants to talk to you. Okay, this is a sound. If you are a diver in the Antarctic, you do not want to hear. Okay? That's a leopard seal. These are big, fast, dangerous animals. Stories all night long about leopard seals. I'll just tell you, they're huge and they're all teeth. And that's the sound they make underwater. So 16, 17 foot animal, that's the gentle little sound it's making. Okay, now we're gonna go on land for a second. It's a stellar sea lion. They recognize each other, just like, I'm sure all the good parents is the same. So that's on land, totally different sound than what you get. Mom and pup, big, huge animals, northern elephant seals. You'll like this one. Mom, I'm here. Mom! Communicating back and forth like that, it's great. We had in one of the camps in the Antarctic, we were camped near a Weddell seal rookery. And the Antarctic is a very, very, very safe place to camp. You could freeze to death, but other than that, it's very safe. No polar bears, things like that. And so you can leave food out in camp. And the only thing that's going to get to it is a penguin, a rampaging penguin. Otherwise, you're fine. We had a pup wander through camp one night, spent the whole night doing, Mom! 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 It was nobody got any sleep because it's wandering around, had lost Mom. Mom had headed off to, go diving or something. She came back, of course, but we got to have the pup wander through, around the tents, through the building, around the whole thing going, Mom! This is also a big animal. As a pup, it's 150 kilos, 300 pounds. Okay, so let's go over to whales now. Generally speaking, and again, this is a marine environment, you've got two different kinds of whales. Toothed whales, like your beluga, and the baleen whales, like the big bowheads and the humpback whales. Two different worlds in terms of sound for them. The odontocetes, odonta, Latin for having teeth, are the ones that we hear about that have really highly tuned acoustic echo sounding abilities. The baleen whales are the ones that you hear from the humpback whales, the right whales, that tend to sing these songs. Has to do with social culture, how the groups work with each other, a variety of different, plus evolutionarily they're different, but it has to, the sound accompanies how they live in the ocean. All of this has to do with how you live in the ocean, really. It's how do you communicate in that type of medium with another animal 500 miles away? How do you do this? Or 2 feet away? One of the things that we know for sure
is that they can hear, in many cases, the sound is actually received in the jaw and then funnels its way up to the brain for interpretation. And in the ones that are really good, they have it's called a melon in the front of their head. It's like an oil-filled reservoir that is the focus beam. So they can focus that beam on you, hear the echo come back off of you, and pick it up in their jaws, and then interpret the signal. So very different from the world we live in, and again, all totally adapted to being in the water. Okay, so we've got two different kinds. So let's go with baby beluga here. And this is a group of hunting belugas. I assume that some of that is communicating with each other. Some of it is clicks that we can actually hear. And probably a lot of it is clicks that we simply can't hear because it's at a frequency we can't pick up. All interpreting where the fish, where you, what's going on, let's go this way, you go that way. We know that many of these animals can hunt in packs in a very coordinated manner to be able to do that. Closely related to them, sperm whales. These are the ones, huge melon. Whalers talked about hearing their ships getting whacked by sound. And we now know that sperm whales can put out such a huge intense, so many decibel blast of sound that they'll stun fish. Boom, put this out, and fish go, wah! And then they can go around and pick them up. Anyway, what you're going to hear, huge animal, right? We've heard songs, we've heard trills, we've heard music, we've heard all sorts of things. Listen to sperm whales. There's two good stories here. One is the next time you're at SeaWorld and you're at the dolphin tanks, those clicks sound a lot like if you run your finger along a comb. Remember, I used to have hair, but when we had combs and you could buy combs. So when next time you're at SeaWorld and you're at the dolphin tank and they're all swimming around out there and you want the dolphins to come over to you, surreptitiously take the comb out of your pocket, put it in the water and go down along the length of the comb. They'll all come over and see what you have to say because you just insulted their mom, you know? So try that, it works great. And I'll deny that.
How did you tell learn that?
We learned that because in the lab that I was working in, we had dolphins. And so we would just, they just come right over and go, yeah, what's up?
You know, so. How did you even do that to start? Because the sound to you?
Yeah, the sound is so similar.
It's
yeah,
like, let's try it.
Yeah, it sounds so similar to that. Yeah.
That was sperm whales. Let's do this one. Sperm whales are highly intelligent. A good friend of mine, who Davis Bay is right down the way from Castellini Bluff, actually, in the Antarctic. We spent the winter there. He has done very, very good job of figuring out how to put recorders onto sperm whales, not an easy thing to do, to track underwater diving, vision, all sorts of cool things. Sperm whales are very smart. I'm a sperm whale, you're a sperm whale. I have a thing stuck on me. And you go, hey buddy, you got a thing stuck on you. And you come over and try to take this thing off of me. So socially aware, and they're going, you got something stuck on you, it looks really weird, I'm gonna pull it off. All right, so Dr. Davis goes out, puts a recorder on a sperm whale, and it's working. You'll hear the clicks. And your clicks. Sperm whale clicks. So have you guys seen the video of the sperm whale depredation is a big problem for black cod, of the sperm whale pulling the fish off the line? You haven't seen this? There's a great video of it. We can probably Google it up. It's looking down a fishing line, and there's a cod on it. And you hear the click, 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 and you have no idea of sound, right? I mean, you know, the fish is like this big, and pretty soon the
this like monster jaw comes out of nowhere. It just goes, boink, picks the fish off and gone. So incredible ability in a jaw that's 15 feet long to be able to do that kind of stuff. That was cool. When I saw that video, I got, are they like fighting? What's going on? He goes, no, I was just pulling the device off.
Very intelligent.
Oh, yeah, extremely intelligent. So here's your friend, the orcas. Also sounds like if you have animal orcas. What's that? Yeah, also get that one. Friends of mine were diving in the Antarctic. The ice was breaking up. Springtime. And they were underwater. It was still dark under the ice, although there were leads out there. They said out of nowhere, they started hearing these sounds. And they're going, yeah, I think it's time for us to leave the water, because they could feel the vibrations. They could feel the sounds coming into them. Now, the good thing about that is orca, as are all the odontocetes, are so darn smart and understand the acoustic signature so well that they were probably saying, this is some rubber-covered creature with a metal thing on its back. It's not a fish. And so they probably weren't in danger, but it's still something that you're going, I think I hear my mom calling. It's time to, you know, time to get out of the water. Okay, bottlenose dolphins. Flipper, the comb animals, really, really, again, highly intelligent, highly able to be trained, and have a real attitude. The dolphins that we had at the research station with us, I come in today, your name's Toby, whatever it is. Okay, Toby, we're going to do this, right? Toby goes, yeah, sure, okay, right, I'll get the ball, do this, move this around, do whatever. And another day he's going, no, we're not doing this today. No, had a bad night, not doing this today. Bad fish, something, I'm not. And so they have a real ability to have a social culture to them. I'm going to get on to a story of talking to dolphins in just a second, but I want you to listen to the squeaks and the noises that they make. And you'll always hear on Google, you know, wow, we've taught a dolphin how to say, you know, Papa Leone's pizza, you know, the dolphin's not saying Papa Leone's pizza. It's mimicking a sound that you've made. It doesn't know how good pizza is, but this is the problem with squeaking. Underwater sounds. Sounds like a puppy, right? That doesn't sound like a dolphin at all. Here's a bottlenose buzzing. You want to hear a second? High frequency click. Very, very common with these types of noises. This goes on for a long time. It's like the animal you can get into the body. A lot of noise down there. If there's a social reason to be discussing this, so I'm going to tell you two talking with dolphins stories. One is that one, talking to each other. You have all the acoustic stuff going on that we can hear. You've got the acoustic stuff that we can't hear, which is the high frequency echo work. There is a theory out there, and the theory is that I have, me, dolphin, have the ability to do such high resolution ultrasound, essentially. I've had ultrasounds before, you know, myself at the hospital, that they can do this to each other all the time. So I'm swimming next to you, and I'm going, whoa, I didn't know you were pregnant. You know, how long before you have the calf? Because they can see inside each other because of the high frequency ultrasound. Incredible concept. I don't know how in the world you'd ever prove that. But physically, from the frequencies of water and the transmission rates there, they should, you know, should be able to do that. So I want to talk to a dolphin. How in the world am I going to talk to a dolphin? Okay, we know they're intelligent. We know that.
And how do I do this? There are really only two dolphin talking labs in the world, despite the number of graduate students I get that say, hey, I want to talk to the dolphins. And I'm going, nah, you know, I talk to dolphins. But how's this done? It turns out that both of those labs are run by psychologists because they're trying to figure out, how do I ask a species that doesn't, I don't speak its language, it doesn't speak my language, how can I ask it a question? How do I even do that? And so they're psychologists that actually do this work. They're on the side, marine mammal biologists, they're mainly psychologists trying to figure out how to do that. To watch them do one of these experiments is amazing. They'll have a big tank, maybe two tanks the size of this room. And they are asking the dolphin, is there a blue ball in this tank? And if there is a blue ball in this tank, please bring it to me. That's a fairly complex set of discussions going on, right? How in the world do you ask that question? So they've got trainers who have been working with these animals for a while. So the trainer's sitting on the side of the tank, blindfolded, cannot see the animal, earphones on, something, well, they just don't talk, so they don't have to like put something over their mouth, but they have earphones on so they can hear the person actually running the experiment who's 100 feet away in the conning tower. So that the dolphin can't take a cue from that person, nor any visual cues from the trainer, because if I'm a trainer and I'm sitting there and I've got my eyes open and I go, is there a blue ball in this tank? And I glance at the blue ball, game's over, right? Dolphin goes, oh, I don't know what color it is, but that's the ball he wants, he or she wants. So the trainer's sitting there like a statue, blindfolded, can't see the animal, doesn't do anything, just sits there. Person 100 feet away says, ask the dolphin if there's a blue ball in the tank. And whatever the signals are that they've trained them to say, is there a ball in the tank, and is it blue? Because they've trained them to recognize the difference between red and blue, and they give that signal. The dolphin can't say, well, you looked at it, so that must be it. So I'm going to go over here, oh, yes, there is a blue ball in the tank, and I'm going to bring it to you. I don't think they've ever successfully turned it around the other way if the dolphin asked the trainer a question, except I'm hungry, give me a fish. But the, what is it, the so long and thanks for all the fish from, what's the book I'm trying to think of? That's the line from? Guide to the Galaxy, that's it. So long and thanks for all the fish when the dolphins finally leave, right? Yeah. So that concept of being able to speak to another species. My wife says, I'm the worst dog trainer in the whole world because I'll carry on a conversation with the dog. You know, what do you think about this? Should we do this? You can't train a dog. Anyway, the concept of actually talking to other species is difficult. They're very, very good at it, though, and they are incredibly smart animals. Okay, so we're done with all the buzzing, clicking noises now. Let's go to the big baleen whales. Wholly different set of worlds. Now, this is Roger Payne. Remember I was telling you who did the recordings, put out the album 50 years ago, of humpback whales from extremely far away, low frequency, perhaps as far as 1,500 miles away. That is far away, low frequency, meaning that I'm on this side of the Gulf of Alaska, and the animal I'm talking to is on the other side of the Gulf of Alaska. That's pretty impressive. Those of you that were either in the Navy and did sonar work or anything, or do acoustics, know that the ocean has density layers in it. Warmer water, less salty water, it's colder water, all these different layers, the blob, all these different things. Remember I told you that sound moves faster in water, the more dense it is. So if I have light water, because it's warm and sitting at the surface, sound does not move as fast through that.
as it does through cold, heavy, dense water. Navy capitalized on this called SOFAR channels, which were where they could hide a submarine in a different layer of water. So that if I was the enemy and I had my hydrophones in this water, the sound coming out of this dense water hit that one and bounced back up and stayed in that channel, in that SOFAR channel, and the submarines could hide down here. Fascinating, but the animals, of course, knew this long before we did, and so they can use those layers to say, I'm going to go long, low frequency, long distance, find out what Bob's doing, and is he going to be over here next week in terms of recordings, because they could figure out how to do that. What was unknown to Western science, again, probably known for 1,000 years, the Inuit, is how noisy and songful are bowhead whales, again, under the ice in this case. I want you to listen to, we're gonna have a couple recordings of them here. Let's pick up this one to start with. Very noisy animals, but what I'm gonna play for you next is this cool thing here. Part of the recognition that these sounds are not just random noise is that they are songs. The definition of a song is a repeating concept. It ends. Some of you are musicians. That verse ends. You go on to the next verse. And then the next verse starts. And the really good acoustics people have been able to pick up the verses, essentially, in whale songs. And the cool thing about it is, let's use humpbacks. The humpbacks over here are singing this year in Hawaii, and here's the song they're singing. La, 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 la. They come up to up here and spend the winter and everything, or this, well, now they're spending it all year round. But anyway, they come up here. They come back to Hawaii, and the song has changed. Maybe by just a few notes. Maybe by this verse repeats before this verse does, or some other stanza's changed or something. But they're all doing it. They all got their new music somewhere programmed into their iPods. They plugged it in, and they are now singing the new song. So let's listen to a bowhead whale song. You want to listen for patterns here. Turn that up a little. Social, clearly highly intelligent, clearly not random noise, like 70 of you talking all at the same time. You'd all have to have been saying the same thing, and I'm not that good of a hypnotist to have made you do that. Okay, let's go on next here. Gray whales. The sounds are different, but the concept remains just the same. Okay, so this is a cool one. This is a right whale. Yeah.
able to interpret that and know what they were. Yeah, it does. And lots of similar sounds. Okay, so let's do this one now. Largest mammal on Earth?
Blue whales.
You might expect, just like Pavarotti's not a little teeny tiny person with a very high voice, the blue whale's big, deep, powerful voice, because they're sending a signal out very long distance, very big animals. By the way, they're not actually making these noises like you and I make noises through vocal cords. It is resonating through an organ, this type of noise, resonating through an organ up inside the nares, up inside the nose, called monkey lips, which are just like your pharynx. And no air is being expelled. So noise, try that again for another experiment. When you're underwater, try that one too. That one's good. Don't expel any air, but try to make noise. So low frequency that we can barely hear them. So in this case, we've sped this up 10 times. This is blue whale 10 times normal. Okay. Now I'll let you hear it at normal speed. Making the singing, songing thing are not expelling air. It's all internal movement. Okay. Hang on here a second. Okay. The life of a bowhead whale is somewhere in the range of 200 and 250 years. There's a whole series of experiments trying to figure out how a mammal can live that long. It's an amazing story. We can talk about that some night too. Think about the life of a bowhead whale that is now 250 years old today. What has that animal heard in the ocean over the last 250 years? Yeah, from essentially nothing except a bunch of them to ships, sonar, underwater exploration, all the noises that we inject into the ocean simply by the fact that we utilize the ocean. It's not like anybody's out there going, I'm going to put a whole bunch of noise in the ocean. No, we're doing things. It's commerce, it's military actions, it's all these things we do, and it moves through the ocean fairly well. Quiz time. What is this? Wind turbine mounted in the water. That's the sound of all the gears and everything moving in that pattern of how the wind turbine works. So we're putting noise in, and as you would imagine, there's controversy over whether or not the noise that we are putting into the ocean interferes with or disturbs the acoustic abilities of the animals. And clearly they can still make the same noise. But now can I hear as well, given this other noise that's going on? This is a ship moving at 20 knots, 1 mile away from you. When we built the Sekuliak, a research vessel for the university, one of the design criteria was it had to meet quiet standards
because we were going to be in areas where there's lots and lots and lots of marine mammals all the time. And so all these variety of things, the way we have to isolate the motors, do all this kind of stuff with the hull and everything in order to try to reduce the noise. But there's no doubt about it. The noise of a 200-foot ship moving through the water is more noise than a ship not moving through the water. Right? So we've got noise out there, and the controversy comes in. Does it interfere with behavior? Does it not interfere with behavior? And how do you determine that? There are lots of people trying to figure that out. Okay, we're going to change something else here. Okay, see if you can figure out what this one is. Tuned way down. Goes on for minutes. Air guns, seismic air guns, probing the ocean floor for a variety of mineral deposits, being able to sense the ocean floor and everything, played at 10 times normal speed so that you could see the pattern associated with that. You go, it doesn't sound too bad. It doesn't sound like a whale singing, so we shouldn't be too bad. Let me play it for you this way. Air gun and the echo sounders going off at the same time. I'm gonna turn the volume down on this. Air gun and the echo sounders happening at the same time. We had a Weddell seal in a study area on the ice, and it was able to dive up and down in the water and through the ice hole and everything out on the Antarctic sea ice. 25 kilometers away from us, they were doing research experiments, again, geology research experiments, and setting off dynamite in underwater in order to be able to probe the bottom, see the bottom, and understand the ground structure underneath. We're 20 miles away, totally quiet. We never even heard it. That seal came boom out of the hole, totally scared, go, wow, what is that? Now you gotta understand, this is the Antarctic, right? There are like no people that live there. So the noises, all human noises are A, really, really strange, and in this case, really, really loud. And they were able to document a couple years after that was stopped by the National Science Foundation that there were deaf seals in the area because of the acoustic hit from the dynamite charges. If you could see the sound signature of a ship, you would see it ranges from very high frequency noises, type noises, down to, you know, rumbles. Each one of those travels differently in terms of distance and how it falls off with time and space, how it falls off with space. The low frequency ones travel the furthest. The high-frequency ones get wiped out pretty close in the ocean. The issue is, if you could see the world's oceans from an acoustic signature, you would see that we've got ships everywhere all the time. So it really isn't a case of there's a ship in the Gulf of Alaska and a whale in Hawaii can hear it. The issue is there's 1,000 ships between the Gulf of Alaska and Hawaii, and there's thousands of whales. You want to get into some really, really weird stuff. When they were trying to do experiments, okay, back up for a second. We're going to drive this equation backwards. I told you that sound moves through water depending upon the speed, temperature of the water, right? Turn the experiment around. I want to measure how warm or cold the ocean is. Let me put a known sound source in there at a known distance and see how long it takes to get to me. So now I've driven the equation backwards. Now I know the speed, I know the sound frequency, I want to now measure the temperature of the ocean. So they did that. They put a transmitter down by Australia and the receiver basically up here. And the marine mammal permit process to do that, this was being driven out of a group in Central California, basically said, we are going to potentially impact up to 20,000 whales. As you can imagine, that went whoop, boom, right? That did not go over well at all. in the community, and in terms of impact to animals and everything, because they were saying, well, the impact is the animals are going to hear it. And then, well, okay, I understand they're going to hear it. The question is, did it actually do anything? We could spend a whole nother evening just talking about how you even do an experiment to find out, does a marine mammal find a signal objectionable? So we're almost done here, like two more minutes. High-frequency sonar, Strait of Georgia, in Canada. Man, that hurts my ears. High frequency, remember, you get high resolution. You want to see something in great detail. But that's not the one when you hear people arguing about whether or not the Navy is causing problems by using sonar and hurting whales. That's a different kind. Here is active sonar. Out there, it's not the high frequency stuff. It's trying to get a different signal back. Okay, so I'm gonna go just back to the beginning here as we close up and just let this play in the background while we're just saying the last few things here. I'll go back to Paul Winter here. Mellow out to Paul music. The ocean's a common resource. Common food. We'll talk about this in the classes tomorrow up in Kenai. It's a commonly used resource. We've got to try to figure out how we share it, how we share it with each other, how we share a new ocean opening up in the Arctic. We haven't had a new ocean that we've explored as Western culture for 500 years, ever since we came across the Atlantic. We do not have currently the social structure, the economic structure, the political structure, or the military structure to try to figure out how to handle a new ocean as the Arctic turns less ice and more water. That's just us trying to figure out how to share the oceans with each other. Fishing regulations, military regulations, who owns what, does Canada own this, does Russia own this? We've got all those things to figure out. We're also trying to share it with them. And that is the hard part. That's the challenge. That's what you get to think about. That's the kind of stuff that we think about all the time in this field, is the reasonable use of resources, and at the same time trying to share it with the animals that live there, not harm them, but yet be able to do what we need to do too. And we can't live without the ocean. So trying to figure out how to do that balancing act, that's the area of policy, that's the area of understanding, that's the whole point of coming to talks like this, of going to any other seminars that come on here at the college, to try to understand the ocean from as many, many, many different perspectives as you can. Because that's our job, is to try, that's all of our job. And it doesn't matter if you're a scientist, an artist, there's some radio people here tonight, whatever it is, the concept is we're utilizing the ocean, it's important to humans, it's important to the animals that live there. How do we balance all that together? 200 years ago, actually, when I started teaching, Reed was one of my first students, so anyway. All right, thank you very much.
Dr. Michael Castellini, University of Alaska Fairbanks renowned Arctic researcher, presenting Sound Connections, Marine Mammals, the Ocean, and Us, as part of the Kachemak Bay Campus monthly Public Square Lectures. It's all part of the Showcase series presented by Kenai Peninsula College, funded in part by grants from the Anna Fawcett Goodrich Humanities Program and the Damon Memorial Fund. You can hear this presentation anytime by going to kbbi.org. Thanks for listening to The Coffee Table. I'm Kathleen Gustafson.